Donald on the Kitchen talks about food. Donald on the Kitchen talks recipes. Donald on the Kitchen talks about lots of other things on community radio. Welcome. Welcome to the Donald on the Kitchen. Happy holidays. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Priskintos.
We gather here once a week. And yes, even on the holidays, we are here to fill your ears with talk about food, farming, advice, recipes, opinions. We are here at your community radio station. We get by with a little help from our friends.
Oh, yes. The Donald on the Kitchen Show is sponsored in part by Practical Farmers of Iowa, a member-based, farmer-led, nonprofit organization that has been strengthening farms and communities through farmer-led investigations and information sharing since 1985. You can find out more at their website, practicalfarmers.org. Also, the Donald on the Kitchen is sponsored by the Mucky Duck Pub, where pub means community. Find out about their annual Burns Night Supper to be held on Friday, January 25th, 2019, at Ryman Gardens. For more information, go to www.themuckyduckpub.com or call the pub and ask for Marcus.
Thank you, Donna. And thank our supporters. We get by with help from our underwriters, but we can also get by with help from you, our listener. If we are in your ears, consider becoming a member of this fine radio station, KHOYFM.org. You can go to that website, find out lots more. Well, happy holidays, everyone. You know, the holidays, they just kind of sneak up on us, and we're always glad they're here. I know there are some bah humbug sort of people out there. I'm not one of them.
The Grinches.
No. Because, Donna, we get to cook. We get to have people around our
tables.
That's
right. This is major, you know, pull out all the stops in the kitchen and get really creative. This is kind of our favorite time of year. Other than, of course, the end of the summer when all the harvest bounty comes.
And then there's the first strawberries and there's watermelon. Sweet corns. We live in a lovely, lovely place to have food. That's good. I like that a lot. Good. For your listening pleasure today, we've gathered some favorites from past shows.
Oldies but goodies. Oldies from the Donald on the Kitchen.
Yes, yes. There was a show that we did recently, well, a couple years ago, with a really interesting man who told us about reindeer. Reindeer. Yes, it is that time of year. We have a special guest with us today. Yes, it's that jolly old soul with the long gray beard and the twinkle in his eye. It's Jim Peace. Jim Peace, yes, it is. Welcome to our studio, Jim.
Well, thank you. It's really happy to see that there are actually two people here. I thought Lana Donna was, you know, was
one person. Yeah, it's Donna Lana Ding Dong, right?
That's right.
We couldn't do it without each other, I tell you. James Peace. Emeritus Associate Professor, Natural Resource Ecology and Management, ISU. And he has been a part of this community for a long time. You have heard his voice on public radio enlightening us about all sorts of things wild and animal-like and what the heck to do with about the squirrels in our attic, all that sort of thing.
You bet.
Yeah. So are you officially retired?
Oh, I've been retired now for, oh my golly, since 2008. So I've been retired for 9+ years, and I'm enjoying it very, very much.
Very good, very good. You deal with all things environmental.
I have to just say one thing. He really does look like Santa Claus. He's got a right eyebrow that raises up into an arch where you see those pictures of Santa giving that quizzical look.
Right.
Well, I asked Jim to join us today because he really is the go-to guy for the part of the world that we often ignore, all the creatures out there. And I'm going to ask him today about reindeer. So, Jim, what is this about reindeer? There's the American version. There's the European version. What
there's
is it
Rudolph.
About?
Oh,
yeah,
them
I
too.
Was going to say, do you want to know about Dasher or Dancer or Donner or Blitzen?
Yeah, no, I want to know about Rudolph.
So, Jim, what about reindeer?
Well, reindeer really the European version of what we call caribou in North America. Ranger fur, Tarandus, that's the genus and species. And like a lot of species, it's really a circumpolar species. It's one that surrounds not just in North America, but across Europe and Asia as well. And there
the
are
North
other
Pole.
Things.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. They're around the North Pole. And when that was connected by ice, 12, 14, 15,000 years ago, round in there, those species became, sort of, they were one species, and they still are one species. But as the ice receded,
they got a little isolated genetic pockets.
Exactly.
Uh-huh.
They got a little more isolated. And so you have some
diversity.
Diversity going on.
Oh,
exactly.
Boy, oh boy.
And adapting
and
to particular
noses,
conditions.
And some have,
Right. That's right. That's maybe where the red noses. I think those are Russian. No, I'm
okay.
Not sure. So it has something to do with vodka. I don't know. So there are other species that are circumpolar that you might not think about too much. One is the snowy owls. Snowy owls are circumpolar. Weasels, the little ermine.
The white one
in the winter. Yep, those are circumpolar. Snowshoe hares and Arctic hares are both
all the fairy tale animals.
Exactly.
Oh,
yeah,
boy.
Yeah. And in fact, the reason they're fairy tale animals is that the winters are long in the north. Right?
Oh.
Lots of times to come up with stories about the critters outside your window. And that's probably, in fact, where some of the other myths and stories came from regarding reindeer, et cetera, et cetera. Winters are long. We're coming up, of course, when
Solstice Thursday, the longest
night
of the year.
Right.
Favorite holiday because
it yeah.
Well, because that's when it changes. Then it starts to get longer.
Season
well, I love to do this thing on solstice evening. I do not use any electrical lighting. I put everything with kerosene lamps and candles just to remind myself
that,
and my family that
is.
This is a pivotal moment in the solar cycle.
That's great.
Yeah.
That's great.
Yeah.
So, well,
so I have a reindeer question.
Yeah.
Are they in my mind, anyway, are they bigger than the deer that we have? Are they just a big, shaggy deer? How much bigger are they?
It depends on the subspecies because they range in size. So what we know in North America, across Canada, there's a boreal forest species of caribou that we call woodland caribou. Used to be, the range used to be half of Canada, 50% of Canada. Was its range. Now it's much, much reduced, and it's probably been impacted a lot by oil and gas exploration, no question. But they inhabit forests, wet forests of the boreal forests that have lots of lichens in them and everything, because this is a species worldwide that is a very heavy eater of lichens.
Oh.
Lichens are those plants that come in lots of forms.
Is that fungal family or not?
That's
okay.
Right. It's actually two different plants, a fungus and an algae that you might say have taken a liking to each other. Sorry. Yeah, I don't get openings like that very often.
No, that's really perfect.
So
they're getting an algae and a fungus.
And a fungus.
They must
right.
have great gut biota.
Right, they do. And you're not talking about the algae and the fungus. You're talking about the caribou, the reindeer.
The algae and the fungus. Like, we should be all eating algae and fungus
of
certain sorts.
They do have the right biota in their stomachs, in their rumens, in fact, in order to digest those. Can be fairly tough things to digest. Lots of other of the deer family, the cervid family, all the caribou are ruminants. That means they have a rumen, a gut like cattle do.
Do they have just one stomach or?
No, they have four.
Oh, just like cows.
And one of those is a rumen, which is really the important chamber because that's the one that's filled with the right bacteria that can break down those plants. Mm-hmm. And if they don't have the right bacteria or they're eating the plants that don't match the bacteria, they'll starve to death with a full stomach.
Whoa.
It's a tough one. So, yeah, so you got to have the right gut biota there, you know, in order to digest these things. And that's true of our deer as well, that eat lots of woody stuff through the winter. If they don't have the wood digesting bacteria, and you feed them lots of hay, you can feed them very, very fine hay, and they can't digest it. And that happens. So we're dealing across the whole world, the northern hemisphere. We're dealing with about seven subspecies of caribou or reindeer. So in Eurasia, in Europe and Asia, they're called reindeer. And in the northern U.S., they're called caribou. Northern U.S. In the northern North America, they're called caribou. It's really the same species, but there are subspecies. We go back to the story when the ice separated them. Mm-hmm. They've had a few thousand years now, at least, to sort of develop some different genetics. So there are differences in size. There are differences in behavior. There are some genetic differences that are detected.
And these are based on that their environments have become slightly differentiated.
Right, right. Uh-huh. And there are sort of three ways that you can classify caribou. One is, are they barren ground versus more woodland? You know,
So what do the barren ground ones eat?
Well, they eat lichens, but they have to.
The lichens that grow on the rocks,
exactly,
and stuff like that.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah, uh-huh. They have to scratch down through. In fact, the name caribou probably comes from a Gwich'in or some other native people's language, which means pawer or scratcher, to describe their behavior as they paw down through the snow to get to the lichens.
So all winter, that's all they eat?
That's
they
exactly
dig in
right.
through the snow and they eat these little lichen off the...
Eat it off the rocks and off the... some lichens, there are lots of different species of lichens, and some lichens stick up they're really tall, maybe 3 or 4 inches tall. You know? So they eat some of those.
Do they get pretty skinny in the winter?
Well, they certainly lose weight if they don't have enough food, and they have to fight off the cold as well. And this is one of the neat things about all the deer species, but especially caribou. They have special hairs. Their hairs are actually hollow. And so,
like possum hairs.
Exactly. even more so. And they're like little tubes of air. And it's the dead air space then that provides the wonderful insulation. Just like when we put on a big down jacket.
Right.
If it's flat, it doesn't give us much insulation. But if it's puffed up, it gives us lots of dead air space and better insulation. So that's what they have.
And do they also, since they're herding, do they like... group together for warmth?
Okay.
And,
that's a really... It's not so much for warmth.
Protection.
Yeah, exactly.
Well,
there are more eyes looking out.
What are their predators?
Oh, Arctic wolves.
Ooh.
And polar bears.
Ooh.
Just about anything that's big enough to take down a caribou. And those are the two main ones in the Arctic, of course, would be those two species. Grizzly bears, polar bears, and
so it's kind of like buffalo behavior.
Well,
in a lot of ways.
Yes and no. Another way to classify them is not just whether they're barren ground or woodland, mm-hmm. But is based on their behavior. And the barren ground ones the ones in North America, do tend to be pretty gregarious. You know, they gather together in these huge
herds. Well, they don't have anywhere to hide from each other.
Well, no, you can't hide very much in the Arctic, and so the woodland caribou, for example, is a pretty solitary critter. They don't get in large herds at all, so it's the same species, totally different behavior because it's been separate for a while. The barren ground caribou, of course, the porcupine herd you've probably seen on Nature and other channels on TV, these incredible migrations. And they're one of the longest mammal migrations in the world.
Where do they go? From the north to the north?
They make a huge sort of triangular circuit. They end up on the calving grounds in the area that we now know as the as a wildlife refuge. They're opening up to more oil and gas exploration.
This is Alaska we're talking about.
Right.
Yes.
Right. And on the North Slope. And so they end up on the plains at just the right time for calving, and because that's when the richest availability of sedges and other grasses and grass-like plants come up, and that's what the young need, the mothers need, in order to provide the richest milk for their young.
So
but then the mosquitoes come out.
Well, but they have fur. So do they, this big migration that they make, they obviously don't respect the border between Alaska and Canada,
not at all.
They just do a whole North American
loop. Exactly.
Oh, wow.
Politics don't bother them at all. So
the wisdom of the caribou.
That's right. Absolutely. So then the mosquitoes come out and they begin to move. They keep moving because the mosquitoes get to be too much.
What do they bite their noses or something?
Noses and eyes and every ears, any exposed skin at all. It's a tough one. So so they make this huge route. Woodland caribou do not. The reindeer in Eurasia tend not to be, while they do form, and again, there are seven subspecies of the of this critter, the ranger fur, the reindeer.
And we tend to forget that Europe and Asia are actually one landmass.
Exactly.
So that gives them another borderless area.
Right. And also the peoples of Europe and Asia reacted differently to the large herds of caribou than the peoples of northern North America.
They didn't all just eat them?
Well, they all ate them.
Okay.
But the ones in Europe, we think at least 2,000 years ago, the peoples of Eurasia, of Europe and Asia, actually domesticated some of those.
Oh.
So that's where we get
the Laplanders?
The Laplanders and other peoples. Actually, there are different different peoples that have domesticated the herds, and they've domesticated them to different degrees, but they all depended on them for food, for shelter, for an awful lot of other things in their
shelter
culture.
Shelter in terms of, like, skins, right?
Skins, exactly. Exactly. Mm-hmm. Really, really important. So,
okay, so those igloos were not really built out of ice, right?
The igloos in North America certainly were built out of snow and ice, but not in Eurasia. The skins provided a lot of the still provide a lot of the shelter for them, as well as clothing in many cases. So they reacted differently. And in fact, it's been interesting. They domesticated reindeer were tried to be introduced into Alaska and some of the northern provinces.
I mean, they took the genetic species from Eurasia and brought them over?
Right, right.
Isn't that because like squirrels? Wasn't there a turf war over that?
Yeah. and in fact, it turned out it wasn't so much a turf war between the animals as between the humans, because they really found they didn't like it to domesticate them very much. They really wanted their traditional way of hunting them on during the migration. So, but somebody thought they had a good idea, and it just hasn't worked out very well.
We were making some cultural impositions, I suppose.
Right, yeah. So there are three ways of classifying them, whether they herd or whether they're solitary, whether they are barren ground versus a more woodland environment. So it's the sort of the ecotype they are. And then whether they are migrating or tend to stay in one place.
Oh, some don't migrate.
That's right. The woodland caribou don't migrate.
Oh, because their food source is so constant.
Exactly. Well, it's more constant than – yeah, exactly.
Okay.
So one of the things they all have in common is that they all have these massive antlers, you know.
Oh, the picturesque stuff. Oh, there
absolutely.
You go.
Male and female.
Male and female. Exactly. Exactly. Very good. Very good. Because it's one of the few deer species that both males and females have antlers, although the male antlers tend to be a little bit larger because they're more for defense. But the females have them as well. It's also a good defense for them against predators like wolves. And okay. That and the fact that they have this sort of scoop shovel on the front that sticks out
straight. Digging in this.
Exactly.
No.
Exactly.
How
and
they
sweep their heads back and forth, and that scoop shovel piece of antlers in front moves the snow out of the way.
Oh, I'd rather have one of those than a snowblower any day. Yeah. Oh, my goodness.
Well, it's kind of hard to get through doorways, though. Yeah, we'd have to make doors a lot taller.
We can accommodate.
We can adapt.
Absolutely.
Adapt. Welcome back. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen. We are around the kitchen table with Jim Peace. He knows a lot about reindeer and other wintry sort of animals. So what else you got to tell us about reindeer,
well,
Jim?
Well, I was just dancing around the room here, around
yes,
the kitchen
was.
To that music, which sounded like a shoddish to me. One, two, three, hop.
Yeah. Hey, do reindeer actually have a... Do they moo? Do they call? What do they do?
They have grunts.
Grunts.
Grunts, yeah. And I'm not good at grunts. So
grunts.
Calling them would be difficult.
Uh-huh. So. But I suppose if they're domesticated, yeah. There's Dasher, Dancer, Prancer, all those nice folks.
Right.
We romanticize the heck out of them this time of year. In the Night Before Christmas poem, they're referred to as the eight tiny reindeer. And I never thought of reindeer as overly tiny. But the ones that I did see pictures of, as you said, that attempted relocation of reindeer
right.
into Alaska and Canada, and they were quite a bit smaller. Short little guys.
Yeah.
Well,
they're again, it's one of the subspecies. They range from, a large German Shepherd sort of size, maybe a little bigger than that, up to quite large. The woodland caribou, as I said, is the largest of the subspecies.
Wait, some of them are little like a dog?
Mm-hmm. They are.
Those are the herded ones?
Yes. Yeah. Some of the herded ones. Uh-huh. Now, there are different subspecies in the herding communities as well. And there are, I think, perhaps one of the seven used to be on Queen Charlotte Islands or something like that. It was considered a totally separate subspecies, and it's now extinct. I think
that's
one of the
seven. That's what they get for being a
separate
subspecies.
Right. Or being on an island, you know, which is essentially what we've
done.
Very
small genetic pool. Yeah.
Right. Small genetic pool and high exploitation by humans. And that's sort of a recipe for extinction right on an island.
How are the numbers of reindeer on the planet doing?
Well, they're considered it depends on the subspecies. Mm-hmm. Certainly woodland caribou are in a great deal of trouble. And they're certainly threatened, if not endangered. They demand some special attention by us. Barren ground caribou to date seem to be, while the populations fluctuate quite a bit.
That means us North Americans have sort of screwed it up, right?
Right. Well, certainly for the woodland caribou, mm-hmm. that's especially true. Although we're not completely sure just what's causing the population decline. Is it habitat,
uh-huh.
or is it other things that we've done? For example, climate change. And this is one of the among the many circumpolar species, climate change is probably one of the biggest threats to most
habitat.
Of them. So, yeah, exactly. Their habitat changes, mm-hmm. or they're not able to adapt quickly enough. Perhaps their food changes, the winter food. Lots of changes that are unintended, but certainly the Arctic is the part of the Earth that has had the largest to date single impact, the poles, both poles actually, of climate change.
That was Jim Peace. And we learned a lot about reindeer. You are listening to KHOI. This is the Donalana Kitchen. And this is Tasty Radio for the heart of Iowa. We're back. Happy holidays. Welcome to our table. Sit back and enjoy. A great New Year's tradition is enjoying bubbly.
So today we're going to talk about the kinds of bubbly besides just champagne and what the differences are. And for this discussion, we have my good drinking buddy, Ann Kinzel, who's my neighbor, who happens to have a French mother and grew up a good bit in France and has some amusing champagne stories to tell us. So welcome, Ann.
Hey, welcome. Nothing better than talking about some mousseux, some champagne, some bubbly, whatever we want to call it.
Well, one of the reasons I wanted to talk about it was because, as we all know, champagne can be quite expensive. And so, for parties on New Year's, sometimes we don't get enough bubbly. So I was going to encourage other people to try other kinds of bubbly that are quite a bit less expensive. And we were going to talk about the differences and what some of them are with, say, cava or Prosecco. But first, let's start with Anne, and she's going to tell us about what method champenoise means.
Sure. Well,
and why it explains why champagne is so expensive.
Oh, yeah. So champagne is sort of the top of the line of the bubbly drinks, and I think there's two reasons for that. One, it comes from a limited region of France called Champagne, about 90 miles north of Paris. And for a wine to be called Champagne, the grapes have to be grown there. So that limits your territory.
Called AOC?
Yes.
Let's see, what's that stand for?
Appellation Originale Contrôlée.
Means the name of the origin is controlled.
Yes, so it has to come from that region. And then the second reason that champagne is expensive is because it's very labor intensive. Champagne has to be stored and it has to be
bottle.
In the bottle. It has to be babied. You put grape juice in the bottle, if you will, and you add sugars and yeast, and you have to store that and turn it on a schedule by hand.
So per
bottle. So don't be surprised if that bottle's pretty pricey. It represents all that good labor.
And you were explaining to me about why you turn it, how you turn it, and what happens with the yeast. Can you elaborate on that?
Sure. Now, I'm no vintner, but I kind of grew up with this, and I've been down in some champagne caves and seen what happens. So they put the grape juice in the bottle, and they add some yeast and sugar, and then they go in, and they turn it. And each time it turns, it helps the yeast and
the sugar. So the bottle is laid on its side, right?
Yes.
Uh-huh.
In these kind of A-frame sort of racks.
I've seen them. They're interesting looking.
Yes. And
ancient looking.
Very ancient looking. So it's down in these limestone caves and all these racks. It's really impressive. And they turn them like a quarter turn. And as they do that, the sugar and the yeast rise to the top. And then when they get all the way up there, they have to take it out.
Oh, the top of the bottle. So they're laid kind of on their side, but with the top pointing up. So how do you get the yeast out of the bottle without losing the bubbles?
Well, there's two ways. What they do is they pop the temporary cork, okay? And at that point, sometimes in the cheaper wines, the less expensive champagnes, they actually kind of freeze the bottle. And then so they can just sort of plop out that yeast and sugar little mass. And the more expensive stuff, they actually pop the cork and it shoots out. I've not seen it done, but it sounds really cool.
Well, the shooting part we can imagine because that's what it does. So then they put in that big mushroom cork after they've taken the yeast out.
Yes. And then I think they let it rest a little bit longer.
And the wire and the, all the stuff that you have to take off of it is to keep it from
blowing up
before you want it to.
Or as the French say, that premature explosion of champagne. Yeah.
And what is the significance of the limestone caves? Temperature? Well,
probably temperature. It's very constant. And the region of Champagne is full of these limestone caves.
Naturally occurring.
Then. Absolutely.
Huh. So describe your experience of going there with your grandfather as a little girl.
Sure. My grandfather sold industrial things, and among them were like tracks for mini railroads.
Mm-hmm.
And he sold these little mini tracks to these champagne, what they call houses in France. And so one day we got invited for a tour, and we got to go down in these limestone caves. They were enormous. You actually rode a little train to get around.
Oh, and that's where they had the tracks.
Yes. And the bottles, saw guys turning bottles. They all had, you know, like little labels on them saying when they had to, when this lout had to be turned. And It was really impressive, and it was huge. I think it was Domaine Chandon, and it was quite the operation.
Well, that's a fun thing for a little girl to do with her grandfather.
Even got to taste a little champagne.
Of course. My son's father is French, and when his brother came over, when our son was born, the first thing they did was, you know, of course, crack a bottle, and they put it on the baby's tongue.
Oh, it seems much nicer than a cigar. I like that. I like that. So we can see why champagne is well loved, well tended, and it should be expensive. Lots of care goes into it.
Right. So if you're like me and you love the bubblies, and you know, like every once in a while there'll be some champagne in my life, but most of the time, like for example, if you're having a party and you don't want to buy, you know, 15 bottles of champagne, we've been exploring in a lot of other bubbly alternatives. And what are some of your favorites?
Well, I really like Prosecco from Italy.
Me too.
And I like the Cavas from Spain.
Mm-hmm. And these are both bubbly and white. And you can readily find them anywhere from $10 to $20, as opposed to at least $50 to $100 for champagne.
Hmm.
So this makes it at least reasonable party material.
Sure. I think some of the Spanish ones can even drop a little bit lower than that, depending on the euro. There's also a French, what we call crémant or mousseux.
Spell crémant.
C-R-E-M-A-N-T, which is how you can sell bubbly or sparkly wine in France where the grapes are not grown in Champagne.
Ah,
I suspect that a lot of the French Crémant is probably sold in Europe and in France and not so much
exported
in the export markets.
Uh-huh. And they're really quite yummy. They're not sweet.
No, I think that the Cava is maybe...
Now, the Cava is Spanish.
Yes. Is a little lighter, in a sense, than the Prosecco.
I think usually it's quite bubbly.
Yeah.
Sometimes the Prosecco, although it's bubbly, it seems to have smaller bubbles, maybe.
Yeah, I guess I'd say the Prosecco is a little calmer. You can be a little bit more careful popping that cork. You're probably not going to get a missile going through the kitchen.
Oh, but that's the fun of it sometimes. Everybody screams.
Yeah.
There's something very celebratory about opening a bottle of bubbly.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that so many people do it this time of year, and probably never again throughout the whole year, or maybe perhaps for a wedding. It is definitely a cause to celebrate. Celebrate,
well, you
celebrate.
Know, people are now, I think, drinking more and more Proseccos in the summertime because it is light and kind of a fun summer drink. I'll drink a Prosecco anytime.
Yeah, I think we're seeing people drink more lightly bubbled wines, mm-hmm, in the summer. So there's the Prosecco. There's also...
Which is Italian.
Which is Italian, yeah. There's also a wine from Portugal, which is very inexpensive, which is not really a bubbly, but it has just kind of a hint of bubbles called vinho verde, or green wine.
That's true. And also I've seen some from South America as well, some vinho verde. And also one thing that's become more and more popular are champagne or bubbly cocktails.
Sure. Yeah, I think that champagne lends itself to wonderful cocktails. I mean, if you think about it, it's sort of like a soda with taste. Huh?
Yeah, and I think the most famous one would be probably mimosas, which are, what is that with, is it orange juice? Is that what's a mimosa? Orange, yeah. Fresh orange juice and champagne or bubbly of any kind. Works yeah. well with the cava or prosecco.
But you can make some wonderful cocktails with other spirits or liquors that really bring out the taste of the champagne and maybe lighten up mm-hmm. The flavor profile of the cocktail a little
well,
bit.
Well, now let's see. We had one last night, and it was lemon juice, maraschino liquor, which is, it has a cherry in it, but maraschino liquor is, I think, from Croatia, is cherry flavored, but not the kind of cherry that we're thinking about. It's a little
less sweet.
Oh, certainly. It's not sweet at all. And it's not red at all. It's actually clear. And then what else did we put in that?
There was some lemon juice.
Oh, and white Lillet, which is a French aperitif wine. And then the bubbly on top of it.
Yeah. It makes a delicious sort of lightly fruity. It's almost a bit warm, even though it's a cool drink. It had
it's a
really
New Year's
nice,
Eve cocktail.
Yeah, it was
it's
great.
A cocktail.
It's great.
And then champagne or any of the bubblies mix really well with almost any kind of fruit juice or like a Kir Royale. Isn't that? That's a classic one also. It's champagne or bubbly with, what's the black currant liqueur?
Cassis.
Creme de cassis, which is just slightly sweet. All kinds of possibilities there for fun mix-em-ups, good ways to celebrate, too.
Yeah, there are California. A lot of the French champagne houses bought land in California in the 70s and 80s and produced their own version of champagne there, or bubbly. They're typically sort of in between the French champagnes price-wise and the Spanish cavas and mm-hmm. Italian proseccos.
Mm-hmm. And there's even a good, I guess you can't call it a champagne, but it's a Gruet, which is from New Mexico.
Yes, I've had that here in Ames.
They're quite good.
Yeah, I have to admit, I was a little skeptical at first. You know, I've been to New Mexico. It didn't look like champagne country to me at all. Big sky, dry. But the Gruet is a really, really nice champagne. They have a rosé, I think. They have a dry one, and they have a semi-sweet.
They have a blanc de blanc, too.
Yeah.
Tell us what a blanc de blanc is.
Well, blanc de blanc means, in French, sort of white of whites. And it's a champagne that's made with only white grapes and only Chardonnay, generally. And oddly enough, you can make white champagne with red grapes.
And why isn't it pink then?
Well, I think it has to do with when they take out the skins.
Oh, so they don't use the skins.
Yes, and champagne is always a blended wine.
Mm-hmm.
So they're blending different grapes, the sugar, the yeast, and they're always trying to get what they call the perfect balance. The art of the vintner is the perfect balance in the champagne.
And you want to explain the different names for Brut, Extra Dry, Demi-Sec, the whole thing?
Well, extra dry is exactly what it says. Brut is kind of in between, and demi-sec, I think, is the sweetest.
Right, but isn't Brut the most dry?
No, I don't think so. I don't think so.
Ah,
I have to admit, that's something where I sort of like them all, so I don't really think about it. The only thing I don't like, to be honest, is I don't like the very sweet Asti Italian mm-hmm, bubblies. Mm-hmm. I like, that's just a little too sweet for me. But that's at the real extreme end of the scale.
Yeah, those are kind of like bubbly alcoholic soda pops, actually. And they're fun for some things.
Oh,
and
maybe for mimosas, who knows?
Yeah, they're very sweet. So depends on how sweet your sweet tooth is, I guess.
Well, everybody celebrates with a
bubbly their own way. And it's nice if there's so many different tastes out there.
Oh, yes, and do explore. And we actually have quite a lot of varieties being sold around town, so you can try the different ones. In fact, I like to have a taste test, you know, where I'll get, say, a similar priced, like we were looking for, okay, what wine do we want for the party this year? So we picked some Proseccos and a couple of Cavas, all in this sort of $10 to $12 range, and kind of pre-tasted them. it's a lot of wine, because then if you buy a case, you get the case discount. But, you know, you don't want to buy a whole case of something you haven't tasted.
Gather your friends and family and prepare to raise a glass.
Bring in the new year.
But don't stop yourself then. Bubbly is good all year round, folks.
Thanks, oh, Anne. Yes. Yes. Excellent advice to live by. Yes, sirree. You're listening to KHOI. Happy holidays. Happy Christmas, Kwanzaa, solstice, New Year's, anything else that you are thinking about right now. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen, and this is Community Radio. Donna, how do you fill your time over the Christmas bit besides cooking?
Cooking, right?
Oh, that's wonderful. That's wonderful.
Party, right?
Yes, yeah.
And we all have to remember that there are 12 days of Christmas. So you can find something to celebrate every day. And then, of course, you can start with solstice, which is Friday. Mm-hmm. And then a couple more days and you have the Christmas Eve, then Christmas, then 12 days of it, culminating with the Epiphany on January 6th, right?
Yeah.
And you can, I guess it's kind of like a partridge in the pear tree. There's something every day. So I know, and the Epiphany also is when all of the Eastern Christian churches celebrate Christmas. Like my friends in the Ukraine don't have Christmas until January 6th.
Well, it makes sense. Supposedly that's when the wise men finally gave up, asked for directions, and finally found their way, you know?
Apparently. So lots of celebrating to be had for whatever reason you'd want to choose.
Thank you. speaking of kind of the Christmas story, things that we're thinking about now, remember that little bit in the Christmas story when we talk about that the Mary and Joseph had to have their baby in a stable because there was no room at the inn?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I want to take our thoughts to the fact that there's a lot of other no room at the inn sort of things now, and there's a lot of activity down at the Mexican border. So,
yep, think, this is an old story.
Think about folks that need a place to stay and need a little bit of love and kindness this time of year. There's actually starting to be some political action down there. I've run across pictures of rabbis and priests and Quakers and just people of faith all over there, down there just kind of talking to the people with guns there and seeing if they can make a difference. I certainly hope we can work that out pretty soon. And I ran across this little thought. Here's a Christmas thought. There's talk of making this wall, right? Making this wall on the border. But that's going to cost a lot of money. And there's something called Institute for Policy Studies that came out with 9 things you could buy with the $5 billion instead of a border wall. And just think of this. We're making lists, checking it twice this time of year. We're doing gifts. Let's think what we could do with $5 billion. Number one, provide Medicaid for 1.4 million people. Not bad, not bad. Number two, you could more than double federal spending on energy efficiency and renewable energy. Oh, that might need to be done, yes. Number three, give the Environmental Protection Agency a 60% raise. We're going to need those folks, I think.
Yeah.
Okay. Number four, increase federal aid to public K-12 schools by 30%.
Good. Yeah, we know we're not spending enough on education these days.
$5 million would make a good dent in that. And here's one that's kind of dear to my heart. Fund the National Endowment for the Arts through 2051.
Oh, for only $5 million. That sounds like a bargain, doesn't it?
Yeah, that is a bargain. That tells how much we are spending now. So if we just kind of pay ahead for that, that would be good to do. Here's another thing we could do with $5 million. Double heating assistance for low-income households.
Huh?
And number seven, resettle 11 times more refugees than we did in 2018. We could find place. Number eight, double funding for substance use and mental health. And number nine, double funding for citizenship and immigration services. That's $5 million, folks.
We could do a lot of different projects, couldn't we?
We could. So, wish you all the best for this happy, happy new year. Gather loved ones around and think of other people that need your love, too.
Yes.
Merry Christmas,
be kind,
Donna.
Be kind.
Happy holidays, Donna, and Happy
thank
New Year.
Thank you, Lana, and the same for you. And to all of our listeners, thank you for listening.
Thank you for listening. There we go. I'd like to also mention a little thing that I've taken to doing this for Christmas, too. There is a
a tort that I've learned to make. A tort, of course.
How Germanic.
Ooh. Oh, a Linzer tort.
Ooh, ooh, ooh.
Actually, this is from a book that has a lot of recipes from Germany and Austria. What it says about the Linzer tort here, Linzer tort, a little pie pan, a little tort pan. It says this is probably the Viennese dessert that is best known throughout the world. The word Linzer simply means it comes from the city of Linz in Austria. The Linzer tort is not a cake in the strictest sense of the word. It's more a pastry or a tart. It's particularly suitable for serving with afternoon tea. I like making this Linzer tort because, kind of picture this, it is like a cookie with jelly in it. The base and the little toppings on it are a really rich cookie sort of recipe, and you fill it with jelly. And
what kind?
Well, I used Iowa plum this year because I had a lot of Iowa plum.
Well, and we have to mention here that, of course, Lana makes her own jelly.
I've got lots of jelly. And I kind of mix and match whatever needs to be done. It does call for an 8-ounce cup of jam. You make this wonderful, wonderful pastry. And it's a cookie tasting sort of thing, but it's too crumbly to be a cookie. So you have to kind of press it into a tart pan. The kind with the removable bottom is very nice.
Oh, okay. Now it's making sense. Yeah. I'm trying to figure out how this works. Right.
The removable bottom. Yeah. It took me a while to get the hang of
that. Those are kind of nifty, actually.
Yeah, those are good. Those are good. And it's really heavy on walnuts and nuts in general. But this has lots of ground nuts in it. A cup and a third of ground walnuts, a cup and a quarter of spelt or rice flour or any other kind of flour.
Oh, so the walnuts are in the dough.
In the dough, yes. Oh. And these are ground fine. And for some reason, and 3/4 cup sugar, for some reason it calls for 2 egg yolks, uncooked, also ground up, kind of to make this.
To moisten it.
To moisten it,
and glue it together, basically.
It does.
Yes.
Okay. 5 tablespoons butter, zest of a lemon, ground cloves, ground cinnamon, and... Oh, and also 2 egg yolks uncooked. So that's all in there. Mix it up.
So do you press that into the springform pan?
It's really crumbly, and it's very heavy on the nuts. You press it. You save a little bit out for the topping. Fill it with jelly, and you can kind of... It says you can roll this. I have never had any like rolling it.
Wait, do you bake it with the jelly in it?
Yes.
Huh.
And
okay.
you smush it into long snakes. It's supposed to be and then you make this I make a little lattice on the top.
Oh, okay.
There we go.
And then bake it.
And then the jelly squishes through the lattice. And when you put that on the table, it's really nice. It's kind of this cookie with jelly in it. It's called a Linzer tort. There is also the Linzer tort, that is a traditional thing. I also make one that is a chocolate Linzer tort, adding bittersweet chocolate melted to it, which is also a big hit.
When you've got that on the table, give me a call, and I got to see that.
Anyway, so think of a Christmassy sort of thing, or any time, but I think of it as
a Christmas
thing.
Oh, so you use a sort of reddish or pink jelly, right?
Oh, yeah. That's good. Yeah. And, you know, it kind of makes sticky, and it's very rich. You just need a little slice of this, and it's very nice with coffee. Or tea. Very good. Very good. You've been listening to the Donalana Kitchen. And we'll go out with music by John Williams and his guitar, Villancico de Navidad. So enjoy the Christmas. Enjoy your community. My name is Lana Nachtigal.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
We've had excellent engineering by Evan Taylor, as usual. Happy holidays, everyone. Eat good food and enjoy life.